Good afternoon. This is the professor, Dr. Rod Daniels, president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century. I am distinguished lecturer at York College, City University of New York. I welcome you. Well, I'm not still there. Emeritus at York College, City University of New York. I welcome you to this edition of Vantage Point here on WBAI 99.5 FM in conjunction with ycradio.org. Well, today we want to begin by asking people once again to be safe. That's right, be safe. Not only for yourself, but for others. I think I just heard the governor talk about the fact that he's a little concerned that people may be getting a little loose. There's been great discipline in New York so far, but we need to maintain that. Not just for ourselves, but for others. Don't be infected by Agent Orange. That's what Spike Lee calls the resident of the White House. So don't be infected by this madness. Let's have a sense of shared values, that we care about each other, we care about each other, we protect each other, and that's how we're going to triumph in the end, not only in terms of this virus, but actually getting at the virus of white supremacy and structural institutional racism and all of the other maladies that have yet to be corrected in this racialized capitalist system. Well, today we're also going to be trying to get five WBAI buddies in line. We'll be doing that near the end of the show, even though, let me just say we're all trying to do that. So we know what a WBAI buddy is now. I know that people have been talking to you about it. That is a person who is willing to contribute $10 or more, at least. And we appreciate whatever you can contribute. But it might be $25, maybe $50, maybe more than that. And if so, we're profoundly grateful to you. You become a sustaining contributor, and that makes WBAI stronger, and we need to be strong in this moment of resistance and transformation. All right, so you can call 516-620-3602, 516-620-3602 in order to sign up to become a WBAI buddy, or you can simply go to give2wbai.org, give2wbai.org. It'll show you how to sign up to be a WBAI buddy. Well, today we're going to be dealing with two major issues, one of which is reimagining the police, and then the other issue is voting, our march to the vote. But beginning it off, we're going to be going to Los Angeles to be joined by Dr. Melina Abdullah, who is a founding member or co-founder of Black Lives Matter Los Angeles. They've been dealing with these issues for many, many years, actually. And we want to get an assessment of what's happening there and what does reimagining policing look like. And then we'll be joined by our dear beloved friend, Barbara Arnwine, actually. Actually, I have to alert my producer that I didn't add her name to the sheet. So that'll be Barbara Arnwine, who'll be joining us at the bottom of the hour. I'm a little battle fatigued. I've been engaged in this stuff too long, so I didn't remove Robert Turner from my sheet. It will be attorney Barbara Arnwine, who will be our guest at the bottom of the hour. But now, let's see. Do we have our distinguished sister, Dr. Melina Abdullah, with us?
Yes.
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. All right. Well, Dr. Melina Abdullah, it is so good to have you. We thank you so much for taking time out from the front lines, and you truly have been in the front lines, on the front lines, to be with us today. So let's get right into the conversation by sort of talking about, I happen to be aware, because one of our board members Akili is very closely associated with Black Lives Matter LA. In fact, I guess he went to jail a couple times or two. That this has been going on for quite a while in Los Angeles. So tell us about the nature of the obstacles that you've been encountering just in terms of trying to push this agenda forward in Los Angeles.
Sure. So to be clear, we're not reimagining the police, we're reimagining public safety. And in that
I want to get to that.
reimagining,
I want to get to that. I just wanted you to first give our audience a little background in terms of how long you've been doing this and some of the obstacles and barriers that you've been doing over the years.
Sure. So Black Lives Matter was birthed July 13th, 2013, here in Los Angeles. And I've been in it since day one. We were born the day that George Zimmerman was acquitted in the murder of Trayvon Martin. And we've been on the ground and organizing ever since. There has been every obstacle, since you asked about obstacles, every obstacle imaginable, because we're going up against the police state, right? We're going up against a system that was deliberately and intentionally designed to produce these outcomes. And so when we talk about ending state-sanctioned violence, really what's required is a complete transformation of the systems under which we live. And so that's meant, individuals kind of having some consequence. So there being some consequence for individuals, that means going to jail. So Baba Akili's been to jail several times. I've been to jail 6 times. There's been arrests and surveillance and acts of brutality and, all of that. And there have also been significant wins, which I think are manifested in this moment with the kind of entire world rising up and now repeating one of the chants that we've been saying for the last 5 or 6 years, which is defund the police. So I want to make sure that as we talk about barriers, we also talk about openings. And then, of course, there's things like making sure that, if you're involved in a movement that's talking about fundamental transformation, radical change, not just modest reform, there are, again, going to be consequences. And so as folks who've stepped into this movement, we know that you can't be in it for your own career advancement. That goes by the wayside. You will no longer be the favorite Black person who's invited to fancy dinners, that all of that kind of are consequences which we bear as a result of going up against an unjust system.
Yeah, that's why I really wanted to begin in a certain place. I kind of have a broad understanding of what it is you're attempting to do, and I have obviously outlined my questions to get to the issue of defunding and what it really means. What does defund the police mean? But I also wonder about the degree to which those fancy dinners, I mean, the whole question of your what has some of the obstacles sometimes are our own folks, people in the Black community, different organizations and agencies who may not understand. And yet that's an important part of actually attempting to move the struggle forward. So I'm just wondering whether you'd comment on some of those kinds of issues that you may have encountered.
Sure. I mean, I can be a little personal here that, at one time before there was a Black Lives Matter, you know this, I'm a Black woman with a PhD, right? And what happens is, you're kind of tapped for things. So tapped to be on commissions, tapped to be in the fancy parties, tapped to potentially run for office. And I remember personally a time in 2015 when we decided to go real heavy against Mayor Garcetti, who, purports to be a progressive, but, the extent of his progressivism is that he had a Black college roommate and was in the Peace Corps in Ethiopia, right? And was really pushing policies and practices that were oppressive to the Black community. And so we had to go after him. And I remember when we staged an encampment in front of his house, me realizing, well, I guess you're never going to run for office. And not that was my own dream for myself, but I think that the system that we live under tries to lure us into thinking that we should seek out what they call a comfortable place in oppression, right? And I think that was a pivotal moment for me when I realized, you know, there is not a comfortable place in oppression, that that's what should be sought out. Not that I didn't realize that before, but, you know, there is the lure, and we have to be very clear about that, that at a certain point you have to commit yourself to killing your ego, to realizing that individual advancement has to be sacrificed for collective freedom. And if you refuse to do that, you become one of these Black folks who are simply Black faces on white supremacy. And so for me, you know, there was a sacrifice to be made around my career, around my ambitions. And then you also have to draw lines for yourself. So for me, I also on a line that my line is my children, and my children are fully involved in the movement, but I also refuse to engage in any way that in any way jeopardizes their safety or freedom or my access to them. So for instance, we've been in protests when DCFS has been called, and if DCFS, Department of Children and Family Services, is called, then I'm leaving or getting my children out of there, at least, because that's not a sacrifice I'm willing to make as, you know, a single mom of three children. And also, I think recognizing this long history of natal alienation in the attempt to sever Black mothers from their children, I'm not willing to be one of those. And so right. I'll go to jail. I'll even get beaten. That's happened before. But I'm not sacrificing kids.
Right. Well, I think it's important to sort of share, you know, so, but sometimes people romanticize what the nature of the struggle is, and to share, you know, the kind of things that you have been going through. And you certainly are one of our, I mean, certainly most visionary and courageous people I know in terms of the work that you've been undertaking. And we have great respect for you for that. But I really wanted to sort of share that with people so they have a sense of what, you know, the kind of commitments and sacrifice is often required. You alluded earlier to where I wanted to go, and that is the impact of, unfortunately, the most recent vigilantism and lynchings, and I don't know what else to call them, in terms of, you know, Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna and Floyd. It seems to have sort of been a, what they're calling, quote, an inflection moment. And I know I've seen Black Lives Matter LA a lot on television. I mean, you seem to have really been, you know, at the epicenter, you know, sort of driving the conversation. So talk to us about what that's meant.
Yeah, I think that, you know, we've been doing work in the streets for the last 7 years, as you said, and, you know, we've been very involved, all of that work, and we're toiling away. Sometimes we'll have demonstrations and they'll have 50 people, you know, but we never miss a protest, never miss a week of protest in front of Jackie Lacey's office, never miss, you know, holding the police commission that's supposed to hold LAPD accountable. We do that every week. We're always in Torrance City Council lifting up the name Christopher Mitchell, and you know, have been struggling for Black folks who are suffering under COVID-19, issuing a set of Black LA bans, and then pushing for a people's budget, which includes funding the police. And so that was all moving before the murder of George Floyd, and before the world knew what had happened to Breonna Taylor and the murder of Ahmaud Arbery. I think something, there was kind of ramping up of consciousness, public consciousness, and then around Breonna, around John Reed, Indianapolis. But then when George Floyd was murdered, in a way...
Sister Melina, you're kind of breaking up a little bit. Are you on a speakerphone or something?
Let me see. I think that's probably my Wi-Fi. Let me walk into another room and see if that's better. Is that any
right,
better?
We want to clear to hear you.
Okay. So I think that... Is this better
now? You're much better.
Right. I think that when George Floyd was murdered by Derek Chauvin in Minneapolis, and we all saw that 9-minute agonizing murder take place on camera. It really, for me, and I'll speak for myself, but I think that it was shared by many African people, it aroused a transgenerational memory, right? Yes. That we watched Derek Chauvin really take on his lineage as the descendant of a slave catcher. We watched his face. We watched him deliberately steal the life and make a 9-minute long decision to steal the life of George Floyd over the pleas of George Floyd himself, over the pleas of those who were looking on, even over the attempt to physically intervene by those who were observing, right? He pulled a weapon on those who attempted to physically intervene. And so I think for a lot of us, it awakened something different. And I think that I don't know who George Floyd was in life. You know, I heard the testimonies when, you know, we watched his memorial services that he was this tremendous figure. And I feel like the way that the world is cracked wide open after his death is a testament to what his spirit must have been. And I recognize that his murder, the theft of his life, is piled upon thousands of other Black folks whose lives have also been stolen. And so I think this is a moment when the world has absolutely cracked wide open, when the things that many of us, you included, have been saying around, you know, what policing is in this country. And many of us were kind of thought as being too radical when we say things like abolish police and prisons. But now people are asking, well, what is police abolition? You know, what does it mean to abolish prisons? You know, how do we get at, what do you mean by reimagine public safety? How do we get to a world that's actually safe for Black folks? And I think that it's just, I'm tremendously hopeful and energized around the degree to which people are willing to invest themselves in fundamentally transforming the world that we live in.
Well, let's answer those questions. You posed them, and our audience is eager to hear, because there are some folks who are still anxious and jittery, and they may be open, but they get a little nervous when you say defund the police. So talk to us about Black Lives Matter LA's, you know, how you envision or imagine public safety.
So we put out a really important survey in Los Angeles around what Angelenos want in terms of public safety. And this was actually put out before George Floyd was murdered. It was something called People's Budget LA, and we looked at the budgeting. And I know it's not sexy to look at budgeting, but really, if we look at, as Dr. Julianne Malvo says all the time, that if you look at your budget, you look at your priorities. Your budget is a statement of priorities, right? And she's our world's leading economist, and brilliantly speaks to this point. And as we started doing that, we put this survey out to 25,000 Angelenos who've responded. And what they said overwhelmingly is they want to spend the city's resources. Most cities spend upwards of 50% of their city's resources on straight up police. So we said, well, if the people had a say-so, where would you want your money to go? And in Los Angeles, the people want their money to go to what we call universal needs. They want to make sure that the 60,000 houseless folks that we have in Los Angeles have housing. They want to make sure that everybody has access to healthy food. They want to make sure that you know, we have access to quality after school programs for our children and mental health resources for our people. So That was their first priority. Their second priority is what we call the built environment. So parks and libraries and environmental protections. Their third priority was transformative and restorative justice practices like healing circles and transformative justice practices that really center those who are harmed rather than centering kind of these really problematic punishment models, right? The last thing they wanted to spend on was police. And before George Floyd was killed, Angelino said that they wanted to spend just 5.4% of the city's general fund on police. After George Floyd was killed, that number plummeted from 5.7% to 1.6%. So people know that safety doesn't come at the hands of police. Safety comes from making sure that people have what they need. And so that's really what we mean when we say reimagine public safety. Start with the thing that actually makes communities safe.
And so how is that progressing? I know that, was it the mayor who made some minimal commitment that initially and so forth? So how are the negotiations going, or is the movement pushing in relationship to the reallocation of those resources?
Right. So we were able to pressure the mayor into taking a step forward. So the mayor of Los Angeles, and really what prompted both the Black Los Angeles demands, which are online at tinyurl.com/BlackLA demands. What prompted those Black LA demands, as well as what prompted People's Budget LA, which is online at peoplesbudgetla.com, is the mayor of this city, who again is one not dissimilar from your own mayor, who casts himself as a progressive, but then often enacts policies that are anything but, right? He proposed an increase to LAPD budget at a time when all other departments were being slashed and at a time when crime is plummeting because everybody's at home because of the COVID-19 quarantine orders, right? And so what he did is propose an increase to LAPD budget by $150 million. All he did, and this was after tremendous public pressure. We showed up at his house on a Tuesday, 5,000 deep, and then showed up the next day on a Wednesday, 50,000 deep in front of the City Hall. On that Wednesday, as we were standing out in front of City Hall, he announced what had already been announced by our Black City Council, former City Council President, and Latinx current City Council President, that they had already announced that morning a cut to LAPD budget of $150 million. Basically, what Garcetti did is kind of steal their thunder and say, yeah, we want $150 million cut. But really, if he already increased it by $150 million, the $150 million cut is not a cut. It's just a return to the status quo and reminds us of, you know, Brother Malcolm X, who says, you know, if you stick a knife in my back 12 inches and then pull it out 6, you can't call that progress.
That's right. So is there sort of, so do you have a projected sort of stage of steps that you want to take? Or do you have a number that you're pressing for, that Black Lives Matter and your allies are pressing for, that will make at least a significant step forward?
Yeah, I mean, of course, our eyes are on what's happening in Minneapolis with the complete disbanding of their police department, which passed with a unanimous vote a couple days ago. You know, we've seen that happen in Camden, New Jersey, the disbanding of their police department after scandals. We see it moving in a lot of school systems now. Oakland Unified just disbanded their police department on, I think it was Friday, may have been Thursday, that they disbanded. So of course our eyes are on disbanding police. That said, a significant reduction in budgets, but also a pivot in the way that the city does things is really important. So much more significant in our view than the $150 million cut is what it will mean if this motion that gets voted on tomorrow in our city council passes. So again, our former black president of the city council, his name is Herb Wesson, put forward a motion that was signed on to by the current city council president, Murray Martinez, and another black city council member, Marquise Harris Dawson, that would prohibit the deployment of police for nonviolent calls. And so even though that's not a dollar amount, what that would mean is police would be pushed back away from these kind of expansionist roles for police. They'd be pushed back away from responding to mental health calls. And I think about one of our dear brothers, Brashariel Mack, who was killed inside the Crenshaw Baldwin Hills Mall when he was having a mental health challenge and asked for help. And rather than sending mental health workers, police were brought in with, and this is a quote from one of the witnesses, every gun blazing, and murdered Brashariel Mack inside the black mall in Los Angeles without even, the police didn't even bother to evacuate the mall first. They shot it up with children and babies and parents all there, could have easily been struck by gunfire, and then were traumatized by watching this brother, this father of two, you know, beautiful young girls be murdered in cold blood. So I think about what it would have meant to have mental health workers when he called for help. I think about what it would have meant. There was a 14-year-old boy, and I hate talking about it. It makes me emotional as a mother. There was a boy, Jesse Romero, who the summer between his middle school and high school year was accused of tagging, and LAPD came and stole this boy's life. Yeah, what would it have meant to have a youth worker come out instead of LAPD? You know, and forgive me, but you know,
this is good because this is what we're dealing with. This the idiocy of what happens is really being exposed now, and people's eyes are being opened, and certainly. You know, here in New York, it was one of the key places where some of this nonsense began, with zero tolerance policing, broken window stuff, all of this madness that brought police interacting with black people over stuff that they shouldn't be in the streets for in any event. But of course, it's much deeper than that, you know, as well. So it's just, this is what's happening. I'm about out of time, so I have to, as a good organizer, and you were anticipating it, because you already talked about the relationship with Minneapolis, and I want to talk more about that. But I really want to get the contact information out where people can be in touch. There were two numbers that you gave. One was about the budget, and one was about, I forget the other one. But please just take your time and share those contact information.
Sure. So everyone can follow our work on social media. On Twitter, we're at BLMLA.org. BLMLA on Twitter, BLMLA. On Instagram is BLM Los Angeles. Our website is BLMLA.org. And then for the budget work, we're at peoplesbudgetla.com, peoplesbudgetla.com. And so we love folks to plug into the work. I know that we're talking about doing budget work or working with folks in New York around pulling back your police budget. And, you know, I just want to end by saying that, you know, I'm sorry for becoming emotional, but it is
Please don't be sorry.
I just want to uplift that this is, you know, we talk about things in terms of theory and views of the world, but when we talk about these people, these are our people, and we can't kill that part of us that remembers that, right? We have to move from our spirit as well as our heads, as well as our intellect.
Absolutely. That's one of the things that my dear beloved Baba Akili often talks about, and he's absolutely right. Sister Dr. Malina Abdallah, thank you so much for taking time from the front lines to share with the audience here at WBAI today. We really appreciate it. We'll be checking back with you, and God bless you, with the ancestors bless you, and victory is assured.
Ashe, indeed. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. It's our privilege. Okay, Dr. Malina Abdallah. Oh, what incredible work. Got some stuff happening in my background here today that I thought was not going to be happening. There's some work being done. I hope it's not going to disrupt us too badly. That was very, very, very moving and powerful. But it talks about or speaks to why WBAI is so incredibly important. I am so honored to be able to have these kind of conversations. We'll move into another topic now that is not unrelated. And I hope that my studio producer was able to get the change, because I am battle fatigued myself, and we need to get our dear beloved sister, when I call her the champion of voter protection for Black America, none other than Attorney Barbara Arnwine. Attorney Arnwine, are you there?
Yes, I am, and thank you so much for having me on your program.
Well, you know, I have to have you on the program, because I'm telling you, you are just, you know, if people don't know you, they do need to know you. And quite frankly, it's good to have you on WBAI, because we know we can bring you on and we can stretch out. I get a little upset when I see a whole lot of people on these mainstream media, even the so-called progressive ones. When I don't see Barbara Arnwine talking about voter protection, then it lets me know that our best is not, you know, on the front lines. So, as
I
said before,
thank you.
You are the champion of our voter protection. So let's get right into it. There are so many different things that are coming up in terms of this voter suppression schemes. Yeah. And I wonder whether you would just take a minute to just share some of the, I mean, there's so many of them, but you just share some of the kind of stuff that's out there that's trying to block Black people from voting?
Well, you know, I have written a piece that people can go and read that they would find very interesting. It's called 61 Forms of Voter Suppression.
Wow.
And yes, 61 Forms of Voter Suppression, and it is available on our website at VotingRightsAlliance.org. VotingRightsAlliance.org. And in the piece, I talk about all the evil schemes that states and private actors and foreign governments have come up with to suppress the African American vote principally, but the vote of all people of color, communities, and the votes of youth, you know, college students, young women, single women in particular, you know, the LGBTQIA community, and of course, people with disabilities. You know, so I speak about the evil schemes they come up with, and here's what they've done. I mean, most people have heard about the voter ID, and folks are all over the place about that. And my point is, it's not that we don't believe that people should have some kind of identification. It's that the states only limited forms of identification. And that's where the problem comes in. So if you're saying that they cannot use your student ID that's issued by your state government, or you can't use your state governmental ID, which has your picture on it, how does that make sense? But then you say people can use a handgun license.
I mean,
how does that make sense? It shows that you're only about having certain kinds of people vote. And for decades, everybody listening, think about this. Your parents, your grandparents, none of them were required to have just a state-issued ID with a photo on it. None of them voted that way. That was not the requirement. Cars didn't even exist until, come on, people, until, you know, the 1900s.
Barbara, are you still there?
The reality that, that these requirements aren't part of what democracy was founded on. We also know that they came up with early cuts to early voting. Why did they cut out, early voting in states and make it harder for people to be able to vote early? Because they found out that if you allow for early voting, African Americans, black voters, will use it 50% to 70 to 80% of the time. We are the highest users of early.
Barbara, you're coming in and out. Are you on a landline cell phone or something? Because you're coming in and out. Have we lost her? Hello. We're having a technical difficulty. Hopefully we'll be able to reconnect with the attorney Barbara Einwine, but she was coming in and out. I don't know what's happened. I also want to ask her about mail-in ballots. I've been hearing disturbing news about how many of those are getting thrown away, and so we really want to talk to her about that as well. But she already said, and we'll try to make sure this is right, VotingRightsAlliance.org is where you can go to get information about these, her article. 61 different schemes to stop principally African Americans from voting. Now, I know we got people in the audience who don't believe we should be voting, and I'll answer about that in a minute. But one of the things I've always said is, given the nature of white supremacy and racism in this society, it may not be scientific, but if white folks or white officials and people within the power structure don't want you to do something, there must be a reason. And it seems to me that unfortunately some of us fall into the, I hate to say trap, but we fall into this, we fall into their hands. We become complicit with their schemes to really disenfranchise, because disenfranchisement will disempower to some degree, not totally, because there are other means that we have at our disposal, and you're seeing it in Black Lives Matter Los Angeles, because you're seeing people in the streets impacting public policy. But guess what? There's some people on the inside who are actually voting on that public policy. It's very interesting to note. Dr. Melina Abdallah's illustration, she named two or three elected officials. Herb Wesson, who is someone that I think I've met before, I think originally from out in Ohio, actually, he's helping to carry the water, so to speak, and two other people that she mentioned. So that means they are able to actually vote. And quite frankly, my position is that, you know, people from Black Lives Matter, Move for Black Lives, should emulate Assemblyman Charles Barron and Councilwoman Inez Barron and actually run for office and win. And so that's a pure, unadulterated voice, you know, on these issues on the city council and in the New York State Assembly. I guess we don't have Attorney Armwine.
I am so sorry.
Yeah, I don't know what happened. But you're back. That's good.
Yes, I've been able to hear you perfectly and all this time.
Well, we may be having some technical difficulties because we're also protecting our workers and we're doing things from home and all of that.
Yeah.
So we see that happen. I notice on mainstream television, sometimes people just disappear. So,
right.
But we don't want you to disappear. We can't afford that. I wanted to ask you, and I gave the information out, is it right to say VotingRightsAlliance.org, right, to get your article?
Yes.
Okay. I wanted to ask you about something specific.
Other information there. Yes.
I wanted to ask you specifically about mail-in, because there's a big push to get people to be able to mail their ballots in, so they don't have to. They can be safe. They don't have to go out and be in line and all those kind of things. But I'm disturbed by the fact that here in New York, there was a woman who came on a program Sunday, Open Live, very popular program here in New York and WBLS, and said to the audience, you know, be careful, because for minor didn't sign the something on the back the right way. Like, lots of these ballots just get tossed into the trash can. So do you have a concern about that, and what can we do about that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, vote by mail is no panacea. By our estimates, if you don't make the right accommodations for voters, especially African-American and Latino voters, 25 million ballots will not be counted.
Oh, Lord, have mercy.
Yes, and it's because of the following reasons. I mean, look at Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Maryland, just look around, Georgia. What you're going to see is that most of these states require that people request fill out an application form to get a mail ballot. How do people even find out about that in the era of COVID? You know, people have to be online and have an internet connection, when we know that the digital divide is real. In Philadelphia, 29% of all black households have no connection to the internet. No smartphone, tablet, desktop, laptop, nothing that connects to the internet. Yet all of their appeals to people to participate, to request a ballot, they had to go online. They had to hear it online. It was all digital outreach. They did not have another form of outreach, although people could call a number if they were able to find out about the number. They did not mail a notice to people saying this is what you need to do. So we know that doesn't work for African Americans. And as a result, the participation by African Americans in vote by mail was significantly lower than that of whites. Significantly. Not just minor, but huge difference. We also know that when you use vote by mail, if you don't send people a return envelope that is already pre-postaged, so that people know the correct postage, that's already prepaid. If you don't, then people can make mistakes about putting the wrong postage on it so it doesn't get delivered to the election officials on time and it gets returned to the sender. We also know that a lot of these states have requirements that you got to use the security envelope. The security envelope's got to be inside of a regular envelope. There's got to be the right postage, and you must have on the security envelope signed it in the right place. So all of these hassles make it hard. Then once the ballot is received by the election officials, a lot of them use what they call exact match signature requirements.
Yes.
And in some places they have rejected as many as 10% of all mailed in ballots. And Maryland, they mailed to everybody. They used the best procedures for voting vote by mail, which is they sent everybody a ballot by mail. Guess what? 10% of all residents in Baltimore, mainly black folks, received nothing.
Wow.
And wait a minute. Wait a minute. You're never going to believe this, Dr. Daniels. But they found hundreds of ballots that were addressed to people for South Carolina in Maryland.
Wow.
So, you know, so vote by mail can be as capricious and as inefficient as any voting process if it's not highly administered, if you don't do the right outreach, if you don't have the right voter assistance. And these states have not been doing the best job. I haven't seen one state
right
that I could point to right now and say that they did an excellent job. Not right. one state.
Right. Now, I want to get to hashtag our march to vote.
Yes.
Tell us what that is and why it is. And I'm so excited about it, but let our audience know about hashtag our march to vote.
Well, if you're listening, you know, if I know that some of your listeners are going, what, how, what can I do about this? How can I help? Well, we're having we are running a national program that is geared towards answering that question, because we need everybody who can to join us in making this better, because it's not just the problems I talked about with vote by mail. There's also, you saw what I call the voter abuse, the absolute, not just voter suppression, but the voter abuse, with grandmothers on canes, granddads on canes, being told they got to wait in the rain for 2 hours before they could vote, after having been on a bus for over an hour. So there's a lot we could do. So what our program is geared towards is helping people out in the field, anywhere in the country, who wants to help, to work with us on the best programs to make sure that our voters are not left out, and that they are contacted, that they're given the correct information, the correct assistance. We're doing videos. We're doing all kinds of ways of reaching out to people. We can do calls. I mean, we're working on all kinds of systems. So on what we're planning is on August the 7th and the 8th, August 6th, 7th, and 8th, in Greensboro, we're having a national conference, and we're inviting people to attend. But you got to come, you know, and be safe, because we're going to make sure everybody's safe, that we're going to have the right, you know, COVID protocols. But we're also saying to everybody out there that you can also watch it online. You're going to be able to watch the entire conference online. And we're saying on November, in October and November, we're going to march to the voting booth.
Right.
We're going to march to the ballot box. Everybody. We're not going to sit back and talk about nobody knew when it was. Nobody was aware how to vote. No, we're going to march. We're going to march in community after community all over the country. We're going to march to those ballot boxes, and we're going to make sure everybody is able to vote.
Well, that's great. And I must say, that's one of the lines. I don't know whether y'all grabbed my line, but, you know, for years and years and years, I've been using that phrase, march on ballot boxes. I've been using that.
Is that right?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. I mean, you go back and check it out. You'll see me. I've used it over and over again, in part because it captures what we talked about on the forum that we had with Reverend Jesse Jackson a couple of weeks ago, and that we must see voting in this election, in fact, in all elections, but particularly this election, as a revolutionary act.
Yes.
That people have to see this as something as important as the civil rights marches. You know, I mean, we have to see this as like seeing that song like Rose Sanders would sing it down in Selma, Alabama, ain't gonna let nobody turn us around.
Turn me around.
I mean, we gotta have that kind of fire.
The ultimate resistance has to be your saying, you know, in your face to all these governors, all these senators, all these Congress people, to number 45, you got to say in your face, you're trying to keep me from voting, but I'm going to vote. In your face, you're going to try to tell me and discourage me from voting by pretending you're some kind of black account and telling people don't vote, I'm not going for it. In your face, here I am, I'm marching to the ballot.
That's right.
Our march to the ballot box.
Right. Now talk to us about information again. Give us the website, or can all of this information simply be gotten through VotingRightsAlliance.org?
Yes, they can sign up at VotingRightsAlliance.org, and then we have monthly calls. We have weekly Twitter storms. We're doing a teletown hall on Monday, July 6th, because we connect up these issues. Like right now, everybody's worried about policing, and should be, because it's outrageous. The worst, you know, system in the world. And we got to get rid of this racist policing. But people don't realize that they have power to do that in their vote, because they can vote for the district attorney, they can vote for the chief of the court, they can vote for the clerk of the court, the sheriff, all these judges, they get to vote for. And they don't realize that those are all the people who are part of the system that has to do with whether or not police exist, one, to start with it, and secondly, whether or not the police are held accountable for their misconduct and their killings and their slayings. It is critical that we vote full ballot, that we vote all the way down the ballot, that we know how to do that, and that's one of the things that we focus on. So, yes, people can go to votingrightsalliance.org. You can sign up, and you'll get notifications to be part of the call that we're having on Thursday of all the organizers around the country. You can join us for the Teletown Hall event that's going to be on Facebook Live. You can go to Transformative Justice Coalition, which is my organization, Transformative Justice Coalition. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter. You can find our website, tjcoalition.org, and you can become part of us. And VotingRightsAlliance.org will show you how to sign up. So you get all that information.
Well, Barbara Arnwine, I've known you for many, many, many years, and I am proud to know you. And you've been on the battlefield for a long time, still visionary, still courageous, and you are our champion. You put together a coalition, so it's not singular. You put together this powerful, powerful coalition that includes so many different groups. And because of the work that you do, we are going to be triumphant on not
That's
only
right.
this November. We're going to continue. We're going to keep on keeping on until
That's
we change
right.
this system.
Our march to the ballot box.
All right. Thank you so much, Attorney Barbara Arnwine. I really appreciate you. All right. Well, we just got a minute left. We lost a little time because of technical difficulties. But we do want to talk about WBAI buddies. I got 1 minute to do that, but you've heard me talk about it before. Go to give2wbai.org, give2wbai.org. Just looking for five today, five people who will give at least $10. If you can do 25, 50, 100, do so to become a sustaining contributor to WBAI and hear the kind of programming that you just heard here on Vantage Point, that you also hear across the dial here at WBAI, which makes us so incredibly important. We have some real powerful programming coming up next week. The mayor will be on, Mayor Baraka. We have an announcement to make about a community listening line that WBAI is going to be partnering with the Institute of the Black World 21st Century on. So there's many, many things that are there. So give2wbai.org. give2wba.org and sign up to become a WBAI buddy. I thank you so much for listening to Vantage Point here today. This is the Professor Dr. Ron Daniels, and of course we're delighted to be on WBAI 99.5 here on Pacifica Network in collaboration with yc.org, radio.org, and we'll see you again next week here on Vantage Point.